Coming live from Slippery Rock, Pennsylvania, USA is our guest this evening. Welcome to this very special edition of the KJ Masterclass Live, the show which ensures that you profit from your time spent here with experts, either through their industry insights, information, or simply learning from them. And today we have Jackson Kurtis, author, certified executive coach, and co-founder of the leadership training company, Happiness Means Business. Welcome to the show, Jackson.
Hey, great to be here. I appreciate you, and I appreciate your happy energy as well.
Thank you. I can only exhibit some energy, but your happiness, your study of happiness, the work that you do, the company that you have, you know, it is actually injecting happiness into the lives of many, many people. And you have been doing that. And, you know, I was mighty impressed. You created the world's first degree in happiness studies. That's not a small thing. So we will talk about happiness, and mainly from the point of view of individuals, from businesses, from workplace happiness. But first, to understand from you, Jackson, is that, you know, you come from a place called Slippery Rock. It's a nice place. But is happiness, is the pursuit of happiness a slippery rock? And is it just elusive? Help us understand this part. Let's begin with this.
That's a wonderful question. I would say that it is, and particularly the pursuit of happiness, as if it is something kind of out there that I have to run after and acquire or kind of hold down. And, you know, the moment I get it, it kind of slips away, right? So when we say the word pursue, the wording makes it that it's something sort of outside of us and something we have to go after. What I prefer is more of the word of cultivate. So then the pursuit of happiness, the cultivation of happiness, really viewing happiness as practice, as something to study. I sometimes talk about the study of happiness and having created my major. And really what that means is a fundamental shift from pursuit of happiness. I need to like go get these things and run after happiness, to saying, well, if I just simply understand the causes and conditions that create happiness, and then I put them into practice, I can cultivate happiness, sort of like cultivating a garden, right? As opposed to something that you run after.
Right. Well put. But let's go deeper into this. You talk about science-based practices for happiness. Mm-hmm. Then is happiness a science? It's an art for somebody? Or it's a feeling, an experience, and not something to chase? Because I have seen a lot of times, a lot of people just talk about happiness, to achieve happiness, and then it leads to stress. How do you look at this aspect?
Yeah. Well, I'm reminded of a quote from this great spiritual teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, who is a Zen master. And he says, there is no way to happiness. Happiness is the way. So it's kind of saying that happiness is a way of being. And so I believe it is both an art and a science. And the reason I say that is because there are some parts of happiness that are objective, like a science, and there are some that are subjective, like art. And so how I explain that is, you know, there are certain things, the science piece, that every human being needs to be happy, in the same way we all need food, water, and shelter. So that's the science piece. These are things like quality relationships, exercise, a sense of engagement, right? We all, those are universal, okay? The art comes in by saying, well, you know, there are certain things that are going to affect me differently, right? I love the idea of public speaking, and I speak on stages, and I lead trainings. But the average person, that's probably not a source of happiness. That may be a source of terror. So it's saying that there is, it's a matter of understanding what are the universal dimensions of happiness. But also the kind of more art side is, well, what are the factors or the dimensions of happiness that really have the greatest impact on me?
Right, right, Jackson. Now let's look at from an individual perspective. How should an individual look at happiness? Secondly, in terms of workplaces, there is a lot of talk about, you know, great resignation and not so happy workplaces. In fact, people use the word toxic workplaces. How can those become happy? And you are the co-founder of the leadership training company, Happiness Means Business. So, and you believe that, you know, this happiness transforms businesses and organizations. The science of happiness can transform business and organization. So how would you like to help individuals, leaders, as well as businesses understand that happiness of others, obviously it means happiness of others, will lead to their own happiness? How would you like each of these sets of people or on entities achieve happiness in their spheres or in their lives?
Yeah. Well, the first thing I talk about often is a change in attitude or a fundamental shift in perspective, right? So when I say change in attitude, it sounds maybe like, oh, just be more positive. It's not what I mean. It's really a paradigm shift in how we view happiness as a concept. So it's saying that it really is something to prioritize, right? And it's something that can be influenced with study and practice. So I sometimes often ask this set of questions. I say, hey, so would you like, do you want happiness? Would you like to be happier? And it's like, yeah, obviously. And then I say, well, how much time have you spent studying it? Or how much time have you spent learning about it? How much have you read any books on it? And people are kind of like, oh, well, I guess not. And I say that not to be judgmental, but to really challenge people's perspective to say, well, you know, if this is what I want, why have I not learned about it, right? Why have I not sort of studied it, so to speak? And then the second question I try to get people to ask, and this applies again for individual or in the work context, is, you know, you have to almost dare to question, how happy am I? Maybe I give it a number from 1 to 10. And once I get that number, what I'll often say to them is, okay, well, now do this exercise. If the person you love most were to give you that number, what would you say to them? Would you accept it? Because a lot of us might be coming around, I'm a 6 or 7. I got to do all this work. But I feel, but I'm like, if your daughter or your son or your spouse or your parents said, oh, I'm like a 7. It's like, oh, I've got to change something. So that's that first shift is taking ownership, not to say that your circumstances don't matter. They absolutely do. But it's simply saying that this is something that I can intentionally come to better understand and practice. Okay. So from there, if we're talking about, let's talk about happier work first. And I won't go too far into each of these because we have a limited amount of time, but I'd say there's 5 really important things to pay attention to. Okay. The first is autonomy. That is, you want to cultivate on some level a sense, but you have to have a sense of freedom, sense of, you know, I have an ability to make choices. If you're in a role or as a leader or in an organization, if your company is not giving people the space to kind of make their own choices, they tend to not flourish. The second one is friendship or connection. It's very underrated in the context of work. But there's a Gallup study that showed probably the single biggest predictor of how much employees enjoy their work and how long they'll stay at the company is how they respond to the question, do you have a best friend at work? Which is pretty impressive. The third one is a sense of efficacy, also known as mastery. So you want to feel as though the longer you do your work, that it is building into something that you are getting better at, right? So you want to develop, you want to grow. Last two, we'll hit on one of them is, I call it belonging. In the literature, it's sometimes called psychological safety. That is the ability to feel comfortable and supported within a team environment, to make mistakes, to try things, to speak up. This Project Aristotle by Google, which is a really big research project they did, found that that was the single biggest thing that separated higher performing teams, was that sense of safety of, yeah, I can try and fail here and I won't be punished for it. And then the last one I touch on is purpose, which is, you know, really just a sense of your work having an impact on the organization or the outer world in a way that is aligned with your values. So that checklist I'll run through one more time: autonomy, mastery, purpose, friendship, safety, or belonging. Those are really essential to happier work.
Right, right. But then if we understand it from a general perspective, and again, all the three places in terms of individuals, workplaces, and even in businesses, entrepreneurs, leaders, whose job is to keep you happy? Your happiness, is it somebody else's job? Either in your individual life or in your workplace or even as an entrepreneur? Or is it that it's your own work to keep yourself happy? Because we earlier talked about it being a practice, and this is something to be experienced and not something to be chased. How do you look at it? Secondly, along with that is, you know, you are an economics major, so you understand in this times, you know, when a lot can be bought with money and people think that, you know, it's happiness is very much achievable with money. Only after you earn a lot of money, then you say, you know, money is not everything. How do you look at it? Is it like the old days when people used to talk about haves and have-nots? So some people will today, those who have money will be happy. Those who don't will not be so happy. How do you look at this whole spectrum that we are in today? Whose job is it to keep you happy?
Yeah. Well, in the first part of that, whose job is it? I would say that happiness is an inside job and an outside job. So that is a quote. I don't remember the researcher that it comes from, but they basically say, yeah, it's inside and outside. So I think it's important to not say it's only inside, because that can sort of overlook the important role that social factors, your management, your family, all these external things play a role. But ultimately, it is also an inside job, right? You have to do the best you can in the face of those circumstances. And there's some research by Sonia Lubomirsky that basically looks at the three main factors that contribute to happiness. One is your genetic set point, which you can't do very much about. One is your external conditions and your external environment. But then the third is your intentional behaviors and activities. So it's basically saying, in spite of the circumstances around me, you know, what will I do to remain as happy as I can? And I think there's a quote. I was just seeing if I could find this quote. Yes, it is. So Charlie Munger, one of the most successful business leaders in the world, he says, yeah, I have what I call an iron prescription. He says that basically, if you think that someone else or something out there is making you unhappy, you know, it's really you who are making you unhappy. So just take the attitude that whatever happens, no matter what, you just do the best you can to fix it yourself. And that's sort of a paraphrase, not the exact word, but that's a really helpful mindset. So it's inside and outside. To the second question about money, what I would say is, I believe it's Dan Gilbert from Harvard University. He says, you know, money does not buy happiness. It buys an opportunity for happiness. So if you look at the 2023 World Happiness Rankings, the World Happiness Report that was just published a few days ago, the top countries are, I believe, Finland's number one. I think Sweden is up there. Israel's up there. The Netherlands up there. The bottom countries tend to be in Africa, Asia, and then Afghanistan was the bottom country. the main factors of the level of a country that predict happiness are economic development and social support programs and kind of, you know, a basic standard of living is important. So I would say that goes back to my point that money buys an opportunity for happiness. If you're living in intense poverty and you're really struggling, you're not sure where your next meal is going to come from, that's very stressful. But once you get to a certain point of being very comfortable, you have the things you need, you're spending money, right? You're taking care of, then it's like, it's not going to get you all the way there, right? You need to have other things in your happiness equation, so to speak, like relationships, like physical health, like meaning, spirituality. So it's really only a part of the equation.
Right. It's only a part of the equation. But then there was this song, you know, "Don't Worry, Be Happy." So is what is the opposite of happiness? Is it worry? Is it stress? Because nowadays, a lot of people are not sad. They don't have any worries, but they are not happy. How would you look at this scenario in today's time? People who have everything, nothing to worry, nothing to be sad, but they are not happy. What are they looking for? So is happiness in giving or getting? Because they say that if you give, that makes you happy. How do you look at that as a former monk, as an economics major, and somebody who is advising companies to make their lives happy by making others' life happy? Yeah. How do you look at
it? Well, I love the question. And often what I say is that the opposite of happiness is not unhappiness. It is loneliness or isolation. I believe the fundamental issue that tends to drive unhappiness is a lack of connection. And there's a more scientific side of that, and there's perhaps a more spiritual side. I'll begin with the science. Is if you look at the longest running psychological study of its kind, the Grant study from Harvard University, tracked all these different people over almost 100 years. The study's still going on across multiple generations. What it found is that money did not matter so much. Health, status, none of those things mattered all that much. What really mattered for happiness was the quality of your relationships. Another interesting part of that is that also is what determined how healthy and how long you lived, right? So they found the number one thing is the quality of your relationships, and that feeling lonely or feeling a sense of isolation, right, is, you know, puts you at a kind of a health risk akin to, you know, being a chronic smoker or an alcoholic. For both our mind and our actual physiology, right? Loneliness is one of the worst things you can feel. And if you think about the evolution of that, the worst thing that could happen to you as a individual, like a hunter-gatherer, caveman, is to be kicked out of the group, to be out in nature alone, because death then is almost certain. So we are deeply wired to connect. It is a need. In the same way, you know, if you think you can just live alone and work on your screen and not go out at night and not, you know, be with people, that's like saying, yeah, I don't need food or water. Like it is absolutely essential. And then the part I'll extend beyond the science into my time as a monk and some of the spiritual pieces that I believe that same sense of separation from the entire world or almost to the entire universe is another source of maybe, you know, there can be kind of big unhappiness, but then there's sometimes this little, like people sometimes talk about this hole I need to fill or this sort of, you know, longing in the human condition. That more subtle part, in my opinion, is a lack of connection, but not just to people, but to the entire experience of the universe. Because whether it is Buddhism, which is the tradition I was a Zen monk, whether it's another religion, or whether it's actually modern science, the ultimate truth is that everything exists as a relationship to everything else. You know, the light from the stars is hitting me right now. We are all made of the same materials as the planets, the moon, the sun, right? All born in the heart of stars. And when you have that awareness that you are, you know, one with the moon, with the stars, with the world around you, I, for one, find that there's a deep sense of peace and what we might call happiness that comes with that.
Right, right. So what are the secrets to happiness? Where should one go to be happy? Because you were a monk. In India, there is a saying that most of your questions can be answered, you know, by sages and by monks who are detached from the daily life. So they can see things much more clearly, and they can tell you not to be attached to things which are materialistic. What is your experience as a monk? Did you find happiness, more happiness on the other side? Why is it that you came to this side? What is it that you would like to share with us about happiness? Where to find happiness in today's time? What are the secret to happiness?
Yeah, I would say perhaps the secret would be awareness. And this ties back to my time as a monk and all of the other spiritual contemplative traditions. I sometimes refer to it as the uncommon wisdom of common awareness. You know, the thing that makes monks perhaps unique is what we're doing at the monastery when we're sitting. You know, I sat for usually 3 or 4 hours a day on a cushion staring into a wall. It doesn't look like I'm studying happiness, but it's a meditation practice, is the practice of building awareness of what's going on in the mind and body. And there's a coach of mine who says that awareness breeds choice. So if I have an awareness of my thoughts and emotions, the stories I'm telling myself, the beliefs, I mean, a great example is, you send a email to someone and they don't reply and you think, oh, this person, they don't like me. What's going on? You know, your entire world might start to collapse. Or you send a text to your girlfriend and she doesn't reply and you're like, oh my, what's going on? She's going to leave me, and you're ready to be depressed. And then she says, hey, sorry, my phone was dead. And oh, so awareness there is the ability to be aware of your thoughts as well and say, my thoughts are not reality. I'm willing to dispute my thoughts. I'm willing to pay attention and also pay attention to an awareness of the sources of happiness, of which things are bringing true contentment versus maybe some sort of pleasure. So that's not to say you can't, you know, enjoy life or do things, but if you really study the experience of, say, you know, going out and getting drunk, oh, I feel like good and this warm feeling and it's quite nice. And maybe I do something stupid and then the next morning, I feel kind of sick. That's, if I'm really study that experience, it's not very great. It's sort of this little high and then you feel bad. But maybe if I go out and just give someone a true, genuine compliment, or, you know, I go out and paint, or, you know, spend time with someone that I really care about, you know, that's more of a quality source. So I believe awareness, right, of taking some time, formal practice every day, maybe meditation, to cultivate that capacity for awareness of your mind, your body, and the experience of your life is kind of the foundation. And then everything else is on top of that.
Right, right. You talk to a lot of organizations. You, because of your training company, Happiness Means Business. How do you pitch this idea to them that, you know, happiness can transform business and organizations, and this means happiness is good business for them? How do you tell them? What do you tell them? How do they receive it? And secondly, what is organizational happiness? Is it the bottom lines? You know, more profit? With organizations facing the great resignation, so many layoffs happening, so many homes getting disturbed because of this, you know, whimsical decisions, perhaps, if I may say so, during the COVID times, or unpragmatic decisions, and then leading to an unhappiness everywhere else. And then so many people talk about, you know, thought leadership and all those big words on television channels and anywhere else they get. So how do you pitch this idea of happiness to organizations, and how would you want to tell them, or how do they see organizational happiness as in today's time?
Yeah. So I often tend to say, you know, I always begin with the business case for happiness. And that's actually a chapter, my business partner and I's upcoming book that we're probably going to release here in the next 3 or 4 months. We say, what is the business case for happiness? And because we're on a, you know, audio too here, I won't go into all the slides and calculations, but, you know, if you think about some of the key drivers of the financial performance of a business, you know, one of them is recruiting and retention costs. So if you have a high turnover rate, you're struggling to find quality talent, right? A lot of that is driven in employee experience. And that is really a question of culture, ultimately. You know, how happy are employees at work, right? I sometimes say that it's standard of living that will get you your employees, but it is quality of life that will keep them. It's a money of a job title and salary might get them there, but it's really the benefits and how much they enjoy their management and their team and their experience that's going to keep them. And so if you think about the, you know, costs associated with turnover, with replacing folks, I mean, especially if they're in management and higher levels, right? It'd be hundreds of thousands of dollars and basically in costs there to recruit, from, you know, the kind of the frictional costs of managing the change. But beyond that, you can also look at just absenteeism, sick days, right? If you're looking more of like the hourly staff, you know, happier companies, there's a study out of England, I don't remember the exact details, but I think it was something to the effect of, you know, they looked at like the top 100 happiest companies, and employees there took like, I think 40% of the amount of sick days as other companies. And the third has to do more with the actual productivity. There's a huge amount of research now that's kind of consensus science that, you know, happier people are more creative, more engaged, and more effective. And ultimately that having happier employees makes you more productive. And that, I think, is all the more true for industries that have, you know, kind of a professional services component, or, you know, business leaders where it's not like, I don't know, how many bolts can I screw onto this door in an hour, right? It's, you know, when you're happier, those people are going to be more productive. But when you're talking about like even especially white collar and more cognitive roles, that state is absolutely essential. So that's really what we grounded in, is an appreciation for the business case. And then from there, you know, getting into how do we do it, or how do we talk about this with companies? Yeah, I would say the number one very powerful phrase that I like to talk about is it's actually a symbol. And I sometimes refer to it as the shepherd symbol or the shepherd leader model. And the shepherd leader is an emotionally intelligent leader who takes radical ownership of unifying purpose and psychological safety. So there's a lot condensed there, but emotional intelligence. Sometimes I'll ask people, you know, how many of you have ever had a boss or a manager that you hated? And then everyone says, yes, I have. And then I say, okay, that boss you hated, you know, how many of you had a boss you hated that had a really high degree of emotional intelligence and they were really in tune with your happiness and their own ability to manage emotions? And no one raises their hand, right? So teaching emotional intelligence is a skill set. The second one is taking ownership, right? We want leaders to feel like it is their responsibility to prioritize the well-being of people on their teams and of themselves. Then we talk about unifying purpose, which I touched on a little earlier, but this collective sense of a shared mission within the organization and an awareness of the impact that they are having on the world that should be positive. And then the final one is going to be psychological safety, which is that sense of connection and belonging.
Right. Sense of connection and belonging. You have explained this thing very well, Jackson. I must tell you that. And you know, there is so much to learn about happiness, though it looks to be such a simple word. It all depends on how one sees it or experiences in their life. So how can organizations connect with you and, you know, get your help, understand more about what you do, and, you know, also engage with you?
Yeah, the best place to do that would be happinessmeansbusiness.com. So you can go there, you can find resources on, we do work with individuals for, like we talked about, as a, I'm an executive coach, work with a lot of leaders in that capacity. We have free resources on the website as well, some links to books, as well as my happiness course that I offer at the University of Alabama. And then finally, you know, if you want us to come speak to your team, whether virtually or in person, all that info lives there at happinessmeansbusiness.com.
Right, right. My last couple of questions to you, Jackson, is to understand, what is your situation? Are you happy? When were you most happy? What is it that makes you happy? And is it a continuous situation, or is it that you also are in situations which are not so happy?
Yeah. Yeah. So in terms of my rating, it's funny. I actually started a practice this year that has been very insightful, and I encourage everyone to do. So once a quarter or once every 6 months, I will rate my own happiness the best I can from 1 to 10. And then I'll ask the 5 people I spend the most time with to give me a rating from 1 to 10. And then I kind of take the average of mine and their ratings. And I think when I did this year, I was at a 7.9. So yeah, hey, the point of that is less to be attached to the number. But for me, that was like, wow, number one, I need to make sure that I am embodying what I teach. I think that's can be something that a lot of people miss. You know, you may teach how to be a great parent, or you kind of know how to be a good friend or a good lover, or a good partner, but are you embodying it and putting it into practice in your daily life? So that was the first part of that for me. But then the second part is, you know, if I can kind of do that every 6 months, then I can track, am I moving in the right direction in my life or not? Because if I get to be 6 months from now and I look around and say, dang, I'm at a 6.5. Wow, I need to check and adjust something there. So I would say that it's a constant progress for me, or constant practice to truly embody this. And I would say that it's not for me a matter of maybe, I don't think me or anyone, if someone tells you that they don't have any problems, they probably do have a problem. And that problem is they like to lie. So it's really, I view it as there's these sort of ups and downs of like the waves on the surface of a lake that are just a part of the human experience. But happiness is really having that depth below the waves of, hey, I know when this wave comes, like I'm still going to be okay. And I have this deeper sense of peace and contentment, even if there may be some kind of suffering in that moment.
Right, right, Jackson. You are very young, and most of your life you have spent in researching, understanding, helping others understand happiness. You have also been a mom. Now, what is it that you see? Is it more happiness or something else? What is it that you look for?
Yeah. I would say that for me, what I want is more happiness, and to experience it. I often think that it's really comes down to the question of, what am I optimizing for in this life? You know, a lot of times you're optimizing for money or for productivity or for getting things done. And to me, it's really about happiness, right? Like, it's like at the end of the day, right, you have to really, I feel like it's fundamentally a spiritual question, considering the nature of the universe. You know, we're floating around on this beautiful blue green little pebble in nature, right? Flash of lightning, right? And the life is over. You know, Dogen Zenji said that this life is like a bolt of lightning, emptied in an instant, vanished in a flash. It's like, what actually matters here besides really truly enjoying our experience and helping to uplift the experience of others? And I personally have come to believe that if you say anything else than happiness, and maybe you say joy, maybe you say love, maybe you say, but it's all that fundamental question of having a very high quality of experience. And so that's what it's about for me. I'm here because I want to live the happiest life I can. And I want to help others do the same, because that also, in a sense, makes me happier, and then it helps them. And it's sort of this, it goes both ways.
Absolutely. Absolutely. My last question to you is that I started with the slippery rock, the slippery slope of happiness. A lot of people want to be happy, but for different reasons, this rock or the slope can be much more slippery than you know about it. How do they get back to that position of, climbing the rock again, finding their best footing in life in terms of happiness? What would you like to tell them?
Yeah. So there's a spiritual teacher named Michael Singer who wrote a book called Untethered Soul. Highly recommend it. One of the best books I've read. And he says this, kind of the essential question of the spiritual path is taking the oath of unconditional happiness. And that is what I would challenge people in that situation to do. And I'll start by saying, it's not easy. If it were easy, everyone would be very, very happy. But what it means to take the oath of unconditional happiness is that when most people say, hey, do you want to be happy? And they say yes. And I say, okay, well, do you want to be happy? But it means you also have to drop out of school, or it means your best friend dies, or it means you don't ever get the job you want. And they say, well, no, how can I be happy? So I say, oh, okay. Well, my question was, do you want to be happy? Not do you want to be happy if, right? Because most people, when they answer the question, they say, sure, I want to be happy if I get what I want, or I want to be happy if everything is going my way. And so this is really a radical act of rebellion, almost, in a sense, in a spiritual challenge as well as a psychological challenge, to say, am I willing to be happy in spite of what happens to me? And now, importantly, that does not mean to say you should not try to improve your circumstances. It also acknowledges that my level of privilege, I've had a fairly easy life compared to many people out there, and there are many people suffering from racism, poverty, etc. But it all still goes down, I believe, to that same question, of, am I willing to not put any conditions on my happiness, right? Say, oh, if I'm happy, if I get this, or if this happens, or if this, no, just I will be happy. And if you can take that oath to yourself, that will become a lifelong practice and a lifelong journey and a lifelong study in happiness.
Wonderful, wonderful. On this positive note of happiness, it's a wrap on this very special edition of the KJ Masterclass Live. Thank you so much indeed for joining us.